I'm VOA's Jeff Custer with this worldwide news update. The UN Security Council is expected to hold closed-door meetings Monday on the situation in Syria following the lightning advance by rebels that ousted President Bashar al-Assad. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has confirmed Syria's former President al-Assad is in Moscow with his family after Russia granted them asylum on humanitarian grounds, and a deal has been done to ensure the safety of Russian military bases in Syria. Reuters correspondent Gabe Singer reports.
It all began hours earlier on Sunday when rebel fighters raced into Damascus unopposed, ending nearly six decades of the Assad family's iron-fisted rule after a lightning advance that reversed the course of a 13-year civil war that has killed hundreds of thousands and displaced millions. The fall of Assad's government is a major blow to the influence of Russia and Iran in the region and marks one of the biggest turning points in the Middle East for generations. Russia's foreign ministry said Sunday that Assad had left the country after giving orders for a peaceful handover of power. Jubilant supporters of the revolt crowded Syrian embassies around the world. Assad's fall could allow millions of refugees scattered for more than a decade in camps across Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan to finally return home. But many questions about Syria's future remain.
That's Reuters correspondent Gabe Singer reporting. U.S. President Joe Biden reacted Sunday to the collapse of Bashar al-Assad's regime. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
From the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden addressed the collapse of the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria by a rebel offensive.
This regime brutalized and tortured and killed literally hundreds of thousands of innocent Syrians. The fall of the regime is a fundamental act of justice. It's a moment of historic opportunity for the long-suffering people of Syria.
Biden also outlined several steps the U.S. plans to take in light of the changes on the ground, including working closely with regional allies. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
This is VOA News. Israel continued its war in Gaza against the militant group Hamas overnight with strikes that killed several people. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Palestinian medical officials said on Monday that Israeli strikes in the central Gaza Strip overnight killed at least six people, including one woman. Among the dead were Raed Gabayen, who was released from Israeli detention in 2014, according to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, where many of the casualties were taken. He was killed along with his wife when an Israeli strike hit their tent in the central town of Zawada, the hospital records show. An AP journalist counted the bodies at a hospital morgue in the urban refugee camp of Berej. Mourners held funeral services on Monday morning for the six dead and nine others who were killed in a strike the previous day. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Health officials in Gaza report Israel's offensive has killed over 44,500 Palestinians in Gaza since the start of the war. That toll does not distinguish between fighters and civilians. The war began when Hamas-led militants stormed into southern Israel on October 7th, 2023, killing some 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and abducting around 250. South Korea's justice ministry has imposed an overseas travel ban on President Sun-Yuk Yeol as authorities investigate his allegations of rebellion and other charges in connection with the short-lived declaration of martial law last week. More now from VOA's Tommy McNeil.
Yoon's martial law decree, which brought special forces troops into Seoul streets, plunged South Korea into political turmoil. On Saturday, he avoided an opposition-led bid to impeach him, with most governing party lawmakers boycotting a parliamentary vote. But the opposition parties vowed to submit a new impeachment motion against him this week. A justice ministry official said Monday that it has banned Yoon from leaving the country following requests by police, prosecutors, and an anti-corruption agency. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
A UN report released Monday indicates much of Earth's lands are drying out and damaging the ability of plant and animal life to survive. It found more than three-quarters of the world's land experienced drier conditions in the 50 years from 1970 to 2020 than in the previous 30-year period. The report was released during a UN summit in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where countries have gathered to address the problem known as desertification, where once fertile lands turn into deserts because of hotter temperatures from human-caused climate change, lack of water, and deforestation. One of the lead authors of the study, Sergio Vicente Serrano, said rising temperatures around the world are the main factor in the phenomenon.
Precipitation is not changing very much at the global scale, but the strong increase of temperature has caused an enhanced atmospheric evaporative demand that increases the stress and reduces the values of the aridity index that we have used in the report.
That wraps up this update, but the world and the news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Jeff Custer, VOA News.
is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhaib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
People are still excited. They're talking about the elections. They're talking about the election process, how everything was smooth, fair, and credible.
That's VOA's Paul Ndiho reporting on Ghana's election results from Accra. Details coming up also. Some civilians say they hope rebels' victory in Syria will bring freedom and prosperity. And in a first for Africa, a Moroccan company is filling orders for Mpox tests as an outbreak grows. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Ghana's former president John Dramani Mahama has won the country's presidential election after his main opponent, Vice President Mahamudu Bawumia, conceded defeat. The defeat in Saturday's election ends two terms in power for the governing New Patriotic Party, the NPP, under President Nana Akufo-Addo, marked by Ghana's worst economic crisis in years, involving high inflation and a debt default. For the latest from Ghana, I talked to our reporter in Accra, VOA's Paul Ndiho.
Thank you, Yahya. It was something that most people did not expect. And the fact that the results of the elections came in so fast, and the vice president, Mahamudu Bawumia, conceded defeat was something that took a lot of Ghanaians by surprise. As we talk right now, the mood on the streets is that of people are still excited. They're talking about the elections. They're talking about the election process, how everything was smooth, fair, and credible. When you run into people who are involved in the process, they tell you they've never seen anything like this from a foreigner's perspective or from a journalist's perspective. I thought this was one of the most peaceful elections that I've covered, one of the most credible elections that have been witnessed. And so I have to give credit to the Ghanaian people, the authorities who organized the election, to the fact that they were able to pull this thing off without a hitch.
And how about the parliamentary elections?
So it looks like the opposition, NDC, is going to sweep parliament. They haven't concluded counting the results yet. But I can comfortably say that the opposition is going to have a comfortable lead going into this next session. Why? Because they overwhelmingly swept the entire country. Across all regions, they did very, very well. The ruling party, for some reason, their messaging did not resonate with people, so they ended up losing a lot of parliamentary seats. But I can guarantee you that this mandate is going to be a great one for President-elect John Mahama once he assumes office, because he has everything that he needs to take the country forward. And if he really wants to push the agenda that people elected him on, he's got a comfortable parliament to help him do that.
And I'm sure you're aware of it, Paul. Ghana's economic woes dominated the election after the gold and cocoa producers went through a crisis of default and currency devaluation, ending with a $3 billion International Monetary Fund bailout.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was all about the economy, the economy, the economy. Why? Because every single person that I've talked to since I've been here, they complain about the high cost of living. They complain about how the money they are making in relation to how things are is not adding up. So from young students to people who sell things on the street to professionals who do this on a daily basis, they all talked about how the economy really hurt the ruling party. Things have not been the same. People are struggling to put food on the table for their children. The salaries that people make were not just enough to get them by. So to that extent, that's why you see people voted overwhelmingly for opposition, hoping that they can reset the economy and do things better.
And lastly, Paul, the organization, the way things went so smoothly, your overall assessment of Ghanaian politics relating to the election?
I think when it comes to the maturity, I think Ghana has demonstrated once again that they are a beacon of hope for democracy in West Africa and a beacon of hope for democracy in Africa. Why? Because they have consistently, since 1992, transferred power peacefully.
That was VOA's Paul Ndiho talking to me from Ghana's capital, Accra. A Ghanaian political scientist says the verdict in presidential and parliamentary elections was decisive, giving the opposition National Democratic Congress, the NDC, a mandate to govern. Dr. Kojo Asante is director of the Coalition of Domestic Election Observers, Secretariat for the Elections. Speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye, he says, one positive aspect of the exercise was the management of the post-election period, which calmed tensions.
I think voting generally went very well. We didn't have any challenges. It's been consistent with the story on voting day in the last two or three elections. Most people had voted by 4 p.m. There weren't long queues, the BVD machines worked very well. Materials generally were all in all the police stations. We had some initial delays in some few areas, but it was resolved quickly. So voting went very well. And then as we have experienced in the past with collation, you know, in some places it turned violent and so on and so forth. But I think what was helped manage the, you know, post-election accounting period and the declaration issue was the concession by Dr. Bawumia, based on their own collation of the polling station data. That came very early on Sunday, and I think calmed, you know, everybody's nerves and the anxiety and so on, you know. But the verdict, I think, is decisive. It's very clear, and it's given the NDC a fair mandate to go and rule.
Dr. Bawumia of the New Patriotic Party conceded defeat and congratulated Mr. Mahama of the National Democratic Congress, NDC. Apart from this, are there other positives or takeaways from Ghana's election that other Africans should serve as a lesson to other African countries?
No, I think the early concession was, you know, really a true gentleman in every sense, because, as I said, the post-election period, particularly the result of management and announcement, has been always contentious. And there was already a lot of anxiety after the polls. You know, there are also parliamentary contests that, you know, are very close that, you know, were becoming an issue. But that early morning concession sort of calmed everybody down, because also the victory was that decisive. You know, there was really no point for people to still be engaged in all kinds of conflict and contestation when it was that obvious. In 2016, Mahama did something similar after, you know, some initial hesitation. But once that is done, it really calms, you know, everybody's nerves. It calms the system and it allows us to, you know, process everything and begin to work on the transition. So I think for me that was the most singular important decision. It would definitely set him in history as one that put his nation above all else and sort of reduced the possibility of any conflict or post-election conflict.
That was Kojo Asante, a Ghanaian political scientist, speaking by phone from Accra with reporter Mike Mbonye. In the wake of Syria's government collapse, some civilians say they hope rebels' victory will bring freedom and prosperity.
Analysts warn, though, that the future is far from certain at this time of geopolitical upheaval. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul with Muawiya Atrash and Ahmed Fala in Hama, Syria.
Amid destruction and death left by the lightning rebel advance and Syria's government collapse, civilians say they are cautiously optimistic that what may be a massive shift in regional geopolitics may also be, for them, a change for the better. This is Ghalib Al-Hajusa, a resident of Salamiya in the Hama region of Syria.
Autocracy is not acceptable from any side, from an individual or a group in Syria. This is the Syrian people's will, liberty, and free and clean elections. Syria is a democratic and civilized country. This is what is supposed to be.
In less than 2 weeks, rebel forces have taken over major cities and towns, and now the capital, Damascus. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has reportedly fled the country. This comes after nearly 14 years of war in Syria, the last few of which are often called frozen. 500,000 people have been killed and 13 million have fled their homes. Many families hope to soon return. Umm Mahmoud is a displaced Syrian woman in the city of Hama.
We were displaced, but we will return to home soon. I am very happy today, more than you can imagine.
The Syrian Civil Defense Force, an opposition aid and rescue group, also called the White Helmets, called the victory the end of this dark period and the start of a new era for Syria. Rebel forces, led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, have said they will practice religious tolerance and respect Syria's multicultural population. But some analysts say the group's Islamist identity and past affiliations with other groups, such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra, creates doubts about their stated intentions. Heather Murdoch in Istanbul with Muawiya Atrash in the Hama region of Syria, VOA News.
After African countries struggled to get testing kits during the COVID-19 pandemic, officials vowed to make the continent less dependent on imported medical supplies. Now, in a first for Africa, a Moroccan company is filling orders for mpox tests as an outbreak grows. The Associated Press reports that Moroccan startup Mol Diag began developing mpox tests after the World Health Organization declared the virus a global emergency in August. Africa's Center for Disease Control and Prevention has reported more than 59,000 mpox cases and 1,164 deaths in 20 countries this year. But getting supplies to far-flung outbreak areas takes time, and many places do not have labs for processing tests. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. Every Wednesdays, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on African News Tonight. Niger's army says armed attackers on motorcycles killed at least 21 civilians in the West African nation. Reuters reports that the attack took place last Thursday near the town of Tera, about 175 kilometers west of the capital Niamey and close to the border with Burkina Faso. The assault came at a time of heightened violence in the Sahel, where military rulers have kicked out Western forces and turned to Russia and others for support. The target was a public transit bus traveling between the towns of Bankalari and Tera in the Telaberi region, the army said in a weekend statement, calling it a hateful and inhumane act. India is not supporting the creation of a shared currency among the nine-nation BRICS grouping, but it is trying to promote trade in its local currency, according to analysts in New Delhi. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump recently warned BRICS nations against efforts to replace the dollar with an alternative currency. Anjana Pasricha has this report from New Delhi.
India is not pursuing the creation of a common BRICS currency, a potential initiative that has met with strong pushback from U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. He has threatened 100% tariffs on products from the nine-member BRICS bloc if it replaces the U.S. dollar with another currency or backs an alternative to the greenback. Analysts say mistrust and differences between major BRICS members such as India and China are a huge stumbling block in moving ahead with a shared currency. Chintamani Mahapatra is with the Kalinga Institute of Indo-Pacific Studies.
India is not supportive of this particular initiative. Any common currency is not going to help anyone. Only the dominant countries like China ultimately will dictate. So it is very difficult to develop a consensus to have a common currency.
The core BRICS group, China, Russia, India, Brazil, and South Africa, expanded this year to include Iran, the United Arab Emirates, Ethiopia, and Egypt. Talk of a BRICS currency gained some momentum in 2022 after the U.S. imposed sanctions on Russia following the Ukraine war and growing tensions between the West and China. But the alliance of emerging countries is too diverse to make a shared currency viable, according to Mahapatra.
We don't have a common market. We don't have any common trade policy. We have nothing in common.
However, India and some other BRICS countries have stepped up efforts to trade in their local currencies to reduce dependence on the U.S. dollar, said trade analyst Biswajit Dhar.
There are 17 countries that have been identified by the government of India with whom India wants to trade in either rupees or a bilateral currency.
Those countries include Russia. New Delhi, which did not join U.S. sanctions, is paying for its massive oil imports from Moscow in rupees. That also presents challenges, according to Dhar.
India runs a huge trade deficit vis-a-vis Russia, which means that when India is buying a lot of oil from Russia and it is paying in rupees, Russia doesn't know what to do with the whole stock of rupees that it is holding now.
Indian External Affairs Minister Subramanian Jaishankar has said that moving away from the greenback is not part of India's economic policy. That, say analysts, is because India's strategic interests are generally aligned with the U.S. Anjana Pasricha, VOA News, New Delhi.
Nearly 50 survivors of a migrant boat tragedy last month that left 25 people dead in the Indian Ocean off Madagascar have arrived back in Somalia, where they were received by government officials. The Associated Press reports that survivors wore outfits Saturday made of fabric with the Somali national flag colors. They disembarked from a plane in the capital Mogadishu, visibly relieved to return. Many young Somalis embark every year on dangerous journeys in search of better opportunities abroad. The United Nations has previously raised concerns over the rise in irregular migration from the Horn of Africa countries as people flee from conflict and droughts. Time now for our sports roundup. I have our VOA sports analyst Mokbilia Baro in studio. Welcome to African News Tonight, Mokbil.
Thank you for having me, Yeheyes.
So, in world athletics, 16-year-old South Sudanese Australian sprinter Gut Gut,
or gout gout?
I believe gout gout.
Wince. Anyway, he wins the 100 meter and the 200 meter races. Yeah. What did Usain Bolt have to say about that?
You know, interestingly enough, we heard about this young man right before the Olympics, the Paris Olympics, and we thought, man, 16 years old running at this pace. You know, if you look at the way that his physique looks, he looks very much like, you know, the Usain Bolt type of runner, right? Slim, athletic, you know, like very lean. He's got a lot of power to him, but he's not as stocky as your usual sprinters, right? Usain Bolt was asked before the Paris Olympics, he was asked, like, what are your thoughts on this kid? He said, I'm going to reserve judgment. Let him run a couple more times because he wasn't going to be representing the senior team in Australia. Mm-hmm. And he said, just wait it out. I want to see a couple more things, maybe towards the end of the year. If he does some big things, we'll see. He ends up breaking some records, some 100 meters and 200 meters. He ran it, I believe, at about like a 10.4, right? And if you look at the distance, and this was an under 18 meet, so he's facing guys that are 2 years older than him, and he's comfortably winning. And it didn't even really look like he was going as fast as he potentially could have gone. Usain Bolt said, he looks just like me. He reminds me of myself at that age, which is huge kudos from probably the best sprinter we've ever seen. And the only advice that he had for him was that, in my younger years, I was able to never have to train because I was naturally talented and just beat people, come to meets and just beat them. But then when I got to the major stage, I started seeing myself sometimes losing to people that I knew I was faster than because I wasn't putting the work in. So as talented as he is, he needs to also make sure that he's putting in the work and continually trying to get better every day. So with that, he said, we'll be seeing this kid moving forward for sure.
For sure. In football news, what were some big games in the top leagues in Europe?
Yeah. So if we're going to start out with the English Premier League, you know, always got to talk about Arsenal, man. This was an opportunity for them to kind of get closer to Liverpool. Liverpool being 7 games up. And Liverpool had a game, which is a derby, against their city rivals, Everton. But there was weather conditions, and due to the weather conditions, the game has now been postponed. Now, sometimes the advantage that happens with teams like that is if you're the team that's in number one and you have a game at hand and you're still in the lead, that game is going to come in a crucial time. You may drop some points and then eventually need to get back up there, and you still have that game in hand. So right now, because Arsenal was only able to draw against Fulham instead of making up that gap, they have a 6-point advantage on them. And then Chelsea had a phenomenal game that they played against Tottenham Hotspurs, where they won 4-3. They were down 2-0. Then they scored 4 goals.
Wow.
Like, what a turn of events. It showed that this is a team that is not like the Chelsea of last year, where they were mid-tier table team. They have a lot of quality players in a lot of their positions. Their new manager, Maresca, shout out to him, you know, because he really was able to condense this 40-player team into, you know, now 22-man rotation that he has going in. So they're in second place currently. They are really in that spot that Arsenal should be in, you know, but kudos to them. And then lastly, another game that we have to talk about is the Aston Villa versus Southampton. Aston Villa was able to win, so now finally getting back on the road. They're starting to get their positioning back in the table.
And in basketball news, Mokbeel, Memphis Grizzlies star Ja Morant made a statement earlier this week about no longer dunking the ball. Yeah. What were the reasons for that?
So interestingly enough, Ja is one of those players similar to Derrick Rose in the past that has 2-foot jumpers, but he lands on 1 foot. Ah. So because of that, you know, he constantly keeps getting injured and hurt. And it's getting very difficult for him to have to miss so many games because without him on this team, the team has a completely different identity. He said he's going to stop taking the risk, start laying the ball up. But just against the Celtics a game ago, he hit a hesitation and came down on the baseline and jumped up. Kristaps Porzingis, 7-footer, went up under him and did a reverse 180. One of the best dunks, arguably the dunk of the year. So we don't buy this, him not dunking. He can't do it. He can't do it.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, as well as our sports analyst, Mokbeel Yabaro, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.